Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. Stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food when we come back. On a China note, Chinese leaders must have attended the Sir Alan Greenspan School of Economics because the central bank has expanded the money supply at its fastest pace in 2 years. M2 money supply grew 19% year over year to 30.4 trillion won after expanding 17.6% as recently as December. The reason that we haven't seen such mega inflation numbers is that the Chinese use substitutions and hedonics, and savings vary by an estimate from 25 to 50% of income. But in December, China announced that it now had the world's fourth largest economy and that they expect to be number two, the second largest economy in the world by the year 2020. They have a huge savings rate. They have a massive pool of cheap labor and strong work ethics. Citibank and Bank of America have invested billions of dollars in China's state-controlled banks, even though some of the banks are technically insolvent. The Chinese economy overall is not run very well, and that is understandable because it's a communist economy. The China economy is a blend of Maoism and Leninism. They have an elitist, technocratic, one-party rule with state control of key sectors of the economy, which include partial market reforms. In addition, within the control framework is the military and the police. These forces have the last word in regard to the business, professionals, entrepreneurs, and social elites. Rife throughout the economy, the authoritarian politics of the state is accompanied by an odd mix of capitalism and corruption that leads, as it has in the United States, to a widening inequality between people. The separation from a command economy has been slow, and they're far from having a genuine market economy as yet. Still, the private economy is less than 30% of activity. In Asia, state-owned enterprises take up about 5% of the economies in Asia, not 70% as it is in China. In China, the state controls more than 56% of the country's fixed assets and totally controls the economy. China has a Marxist-Leninist economy, and for all intents and purposes, there has been very little political, financial, or economic change in China. Almost everything is controlled by the state. There has been little liberalization, and we see very little in China's future. Communism commands and secures the loyalty of supporters by appointing 81% of its CEOs to state enterprises and 56% of senior corporate executives. Eventually, this incestuous relationship leads to failure because it doesn't allow the best to rise to the top. The state's economic dominance preserves systemic economic inefficiency as scarce resources are funneled to local elites and bureaucratic constituencies. Politically motivated lending was responsible for 60% of all of the bad loans made in China, and almost all state-run enterprises are unprofitable. Even in boom years, the median return on assets has been 1.5%. Corruption is unbelievable, and of all party members caught stealing, only 3% were prosecuted. Further, many are on the bankrolls of the triads involved in murder, extortion, prostitution, and gambling. Income inequality has increased 50% since the 1970s, making China the most unequal society in Asia. 1% of households control 60% of the wealth. In the United States, 5% of households control 60% of the wealth. Not surprisingly, little is spent on education and health. The country's economic growth generated by Washington and the United States market has lent legitimacy to this incompetent state, and it has believed or relieved pressure to liberalize. Thus, billions of won have been spent on the People's Armed Police that has been deployed in suppressing internal unrest. There are more than 30,000 internet police as well, who are now assisted by Google and Microsoft. They employ selective repression, targeting those who openly challenge their authority. Dissent is not permitted, but corruption flourishes. Now, this is a view that you're not going to get from your local controlled media. Foreign exchange reserves in China rose $26.8 billion in January to reach $845 billion. There's a report on China from the International Forecaster. All right, this week's report, producing good food. Listen to this. You know, the average American household making between $22,500 and $30,000 a year spends about 16% of their income, or approximately $5,000 of its income, on food. Now, if the household makes between $40,000 and $60,000 a year, then that household will spend about 10%, or about $6,000, on food. 12% of American households now purchase organic produce, and they buy from health and health food stores, organic produce salesmen, or they buy from farmers markets. Now, that translates into some 34 million people coast to coast and border to border, and already there are more than 4,000 small organic farms producing organic fruits and vegetables and meats on 25 acres or less, and they're making at least $100,000 a year serving this growing specialty market. And some of these farms are as small as 3 acres, and they're in every state in the union. You know, old Henry Kaiser summed it up quite nicely when he said of his business success, find a need and fill it. And here's a need that's just waiting to be filled. Now, the law school has a program to teach you how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. This is a 5-day school, and it includes lessons on marketing, business plans, growing organic foods, and the law that governs it all. Why don't you call and order today our free 4-hour CD package. Remember, it's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. The number to call, 417-273-4967 to order yours. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, georgegordon.org. That phone number again, 417-273-4967. In a publication called Grain, G-R-A-I-N, a story is unfolding. The other side of the poultry industry's central role in the bird flu epidemic around the world. You've probably heard of factory farms. Here in America, we have gigantic farming enterprises now. We no longer farm with families and the local family farm or the small family farm. We now have multinational conglomerates and corporations that do our farming for us. Operations like ConAgra and Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland. And these big corporations have what we call big corporate farms or factory farms. These big factory farms in some cases have 10,000 sows producing pork, or they'll have tens of thousands and in some cases a million chickens in one factory farm operation. And then we have the big cattle operations. Not big cattle operations that you think of from the movies in Hollywood where John Wayne is trailing cattle from Texas up to Chicago. These big factory farms are called feedlots, and they're all over the Midwest. And some of them have up to 100,000 cattle confined in these feedlots. Now, how does that affect food and food quality? How does that affect disease? Now, if you've been watching the bird flu epidemic, we've been told that bird flu is spread by migratory birds, and that the bird flu epidemic is exacerbated by little small flocks of chickens, especially in Asia, where tens of thousands of small, poor families living on $1 or $2 a day have a handful of chickens in the backyard. And these chickens in the backyard, combined with the migratory birds, are causing this bird flu pandemic, at least among chickens, ducks, and geese, and swans worldwide. And it actually threatens a worldwide pandemic. That's the story we've been told. Well, here's the other side of the story. Backyard or free-range poultry are not fueling the current wave of bird flu outbreaks that are stalking large parts of the world. The deadly H5N1 strain of bird flu is essentially a problem of industrial poultry practices. Its epicenter is the factory farms of China and Southeast Asia, and while it is true that wild birds can carry the disease, at least for short distances, its main vector is the highly self-regulated and transnational poultry industry, which sends the products and the waste products of its farms around the world through a multitude of channels. And yet, small poultry farmers and the poultry biodiversity and local food security that they sustain are suffering badly from the fallout. And to make matters worse, governments and international agencies, following the mistaken assumptions about how the disease spreads and amplifies, are pursuing measures to force poultry indoors and further industrialize the poultry sector. In practice, this means the end of the small-scale poultry farming that provides food and livelihoods to hundreds of millions of families around the world. Now, this paper presents a fresh perspective on the bird flu story that challenges current assumptions and puts the focus back where it should be, on the transnational poultry industry. This report from www.grain.org, spelled G-R-A-I-N, is available on the internet free of charge. Again, that's www.grain.org. All right, let's see here. The men in white rubber suits and gas masks that you see chasing down chickens on the 6 o'clock news in rural villages. Chickens sold and slaughtered in live markets. Wild birds flying across the sky. These are the typical images that are broadcast by the news media in its coverage of the bird flu epidemic. Rare are photos of the booming transnational poultry industry, the huge factory farms with multiple hundreds of thousands, and in some cases up to a million chickens in one industrial complex. There are no shots of these factory farms being hit by the virus, and no images of its overcrowded trucks transporting live chickens or its feed mills converting poultry byproducts into chicken feed. The selection of images that you see sends a clear message. Bird flu is a problem of wild birds, and the backwards poultry practices not modern industry. And in this way, the most fundamental piece of information needed to understand this recent avian influenza outbreak gets left out of the picture. For thousands of years, people have been keeping chickens, ducks, geese, and swans. Only in recent years have we seen these millions and millions of birds, or hundreds and hundreds of thousands of birds, being kept in factory environments. Bird flu is really nothing new. Bird flu has coexisted rather peacefully with wild birds and small-scale poultry farming and live markets for thousands of years. But the wave of highly pathogenic strains of bird flu that have decimated poultry and killed people across the world over the past 10 years is unprecedented, as is today's transnational poultry industry. It's a new phenomenon. Now, the transformation of poultry production in Asia in recent decades is staggering. In the Southeast Asian countries, where most of this bird flu outbreaks are concentrated, such as Thailand, Indonesia, and Vietnam, production of poultry has jumped eightfold in just 30 years. From around 300,000 metric tons of chicken meat in 1971 to approximately 2.5 million tons in 2001. China's production of chicken tripled during the 1990s to over 9 million metric tons per year. Practically all of this new poultry production has occurred on state-owned factory farms concentrated outside of major cities and integrated into the transnational production system worldwide. And this is the ideal breeding ground for highly pathogenic bird flu, like the H5N1 strain, threatening to explode into a human flu pandemic at any moment. Nevertheless, the many papers, statements, and strategy documents coming out of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, it's called the FAO, and the World Health Organization, called the WHO, and relevant government agencies contained barely a whisper about the implications of industrial factory farms where poultry is grown in the bird flu crisis. Instead, fingers are pointed at backyard farms with calls for tighter controls on these backyard farm operations and greater restructuring of the poultry sector. The big poultry corporations are even trying to use the bird flu outbreak as an opportunity to do away with what is left of small-scale poultry production. They're trying to eliminate their competitors. Now, we cannot control migratory birds, but we can surely work hard to close down as many backyard farms as possible, said Margaret Say. She's the Southeast Asian director for the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council. Now, the reactions from some scientists are no less outrageous. Researchers in the United Kingdom are pursuing transgenic bird flu resistant chickens. And once we have regulatory approval, we believe that it will take only between 4 and 5 years to breed enough chickens to replace the entire world population of chickens, said Lawrence Tilley. He's a professor of molecular virology at Cambridge University. Now, backyard farming is not an idle pastime for most landowners around the world. It is the crux of food security and farming income for hundreds of millions of rural poor in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, providing a third of the protein intake for the average rural household. Nearly all rural households in Asia keep at least a few chickens for meat, eggs, and even fertilizer, and they're often the only livestock that poor farmers can afford. The birds are thus critical to their diversified farming methods, just as the genetic diversity of poultry on small farms is critical to the long-term survival of poultry farming in general. Now, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, knows this. Before the Asian bird flu crisis, the FAO vaunted the benefits of backyard poultry for the rural poor and biodiversity and ran programs encouraging such programs. But today, with the H5N1 strain at the gates of Western Europe, it is more common to hear the FAO speak of the risks of backyard farming, and this is a reckless mistake when it comes to bird flu. Diverse, small-scale poultry farming is the solution, not the problem. The problem comes from overcrowding and the factory farming mistake. Now, backyard poultry is the solution to the problem. It is not the cause of the problem. Now, the argument used against backyard farming generally goes like this. In backyard farms, the poultry wander around out in the open, eating bugs and worms and grass in the open pasture, coming into frequent contact as they do with wild birds carrying the bird flu virus and humans who are vulnerable to transmission. These farms are thus said to act like a mixing bowl for the constant circulation of the disease. Backyard farms are also frustrating for authorities because their very nature. They're small, small-scale, free-range, scattered, and informal. And it makes it very difficult for them to implement their two major control measures, culling and vaccination. Now, the argument is widely accepted by governments around the world, and today, most farm-level laws and policies for the control of bird flu seek to keep poultry separated from wild birds, as we see in Table 1. These are the measures to control bird flu targeting backyard poultry in a selection of countries. Countries such as Austria, Canada, China, Croatia, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Nigeria, Norway, Slovenia, Sweden, Switzerland, Thailand, the Ukraine, and Vietnam. These countries now have a ban on outdoor poultry during migration season. In some cases, they have a ban on outdoor poultry in total. Now, by and large, these laws and policies are totally impractical, especially for small farmers. In Southeast Asia, governments with the support of the FAO are encouraging farmers to set up mesh screens or bamboo enclosures for their poultry. But the costs of these kinds of installations are estimated at $50 to $70. And they're totally out of reach for people that are subsisting on $1 or $2 a day, especially for Asia's smallholders who typically make less than $1 a day. And in places like Thailand, where such measures have been enacted, it has immediately forced small farmers to abandon poultry altogether. Even organic measures have been enacted. Organic farmers in Switzerland are giving up their flocks because they cannot afford the added cost of bringing their birds indoors. Furthermore, organic farmers who do not allow their livestock free access to the outdoors, as organic standards around the world require, are at risk of losing their organic certification. So the impacts of these measures are already real for farmers, even if bird flu is not present in their area, and even if there is no evidence that keeping birds indoors will do anything to stop the virus. This, in short, is an attack by commercial poultry interests against organic poultry raising practices. Now let's take a look at wild birds and poultry. Should not mix, or should they? The movement of migratory birds has caused outbreaks to emerge in several countries and regions simultaneously. So said the Food and Agriculture Organization on November the 11th, 2005. Now, despite such statements from the FAO or the World Health Organization, there is still very little evidence that migratory birds carrying and transmitting highly pathogenic H5N1 after testing hundreds of thousands of wild birds for the disease. Scientists have only rarely identified live birds carrying bird flu in a highly pathogenic form. And as the FAO has stated as recently as November of 2005, quote, to date, extensive testing of clinically normal migratory birds in the infected countries has not produced any positive results for H5N1 so far. Now, boys and girls, did you hear that statement? Let me read it to you again. Now, this is to date. This is the Food and Agriculture Association, FAO, as of November 2005. They said, to date, extensive testing of clinically normal migratory birds in these infected countries has not produced any positive results for H5N1 so far. They haven't found a single migratory bird so far with this flu virus. Well, if that's the case, then how in hell is the flu virus being spread around the world? Well, it's not coming from migratory birds, and that's what we're being told. Nearly all wild birds that have tested positive for the disease were dead, and in most cases they were found near to outbreaks in domestic poultry. Even with the current cases of H5N1 in wild birds in Europe, experts agree that these birds probably contracted the virus in the Black Sea region, where H5N1 is well established in poultry, in these massive poultry industrial farms, and they died while heading westward to escape the unusually cold conditions in the area. So the trail leads to the factory farms, not to the backyard farms. No live birds have been found with it, only dead birds. One popular incident cited in the case against wild birds was a mass outbreak of H5N1 among geese in Qinghai Lake, North China. A theory was quickly constructed as to how the virus was then carried westward by migratory birds to Kazakhstan, Russia, and Turkey. But bird conservationists, and notably the organization BirdLife International, pointed out that Qinghai Lake has many surrounding poultry operations, factory farms, and they also noted that there is a fish farm in the area that the Food and Agriculture Organization helped to construct, and that the chicken feces from the factory farms are commonly used as food and fertilizer in integrated fish farms in China. Furthermore, many strains and many trains and train loads and roads connect the Qinghai Lake area to areas of bird flu outbreaks, like Lin Cao, the source of infected poultry that caused an earlier outbreak of H5N1 in Tibet, 1,500 miles away. However, none of these alternative scenarios drew very much attention from the FAO or other major international authorities. Now, the main weakness in this migratory bird theory is that the geographical spread of the disease does not match with the migratory routes of the birds or the migratory seasons. No species migrates from Qinghai, China, west to eastern Europe, says BirdLife's Dr. Richard Thomas. When plotted, the pattern of outbreaks of bird flu follows the major road and rail routes, not the flyways. And the absence of outbreaks in Africa, South and Southeast Asia, and Australasia this autumn is very hard to explain if wild birds are in fact the primary carriers. If migratory birds are transmitting the disease, then why has bird flu not hit the Philippines or Burma? And why has it been confined to a few commercial operations, the major factory farms in Laos, when all three countries are in fact surrounded by bird flu infected countries? Even if it is possible for migratory birds to transport the disease, as recent cases in Europe suggest, there are much more significant vectors of transmission that should be the focus of attention. There is simply no good reason to batten down the hatches and force poultry indoors. Well, let's pause right here and give you a broadcast reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that these authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are in fact political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about food. How to produce good food. Now, we're being told by the United Nations and our government that bird flu is caused by wild birds that come in contact with backyard flocks. It's not quite clear who it is that has this flu. Where did this flu come from? Did the wild birds pick up this H5N1 flu virus from the backyard flock, and then they're spreading it now to other locations on their migratory routes? Or do the wild birds have, or did the wild birds develop this H5N1 flu? And then, if that's the case, then are they spreading it to the backyard flocks? And is that why it's necessary to kill these backyard flocks of chickens? Or three, is the H5N1 flu virus generated by these mega factory farms with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and even in some cases a million birds or more? And then, is that flu being transmitted not by wild birds, but rather transported by rail and truck and the normal communications of commerce, and that wild birds coming into contact in some way with these birds or with this feces or with these guts or with these products, then coming down as an incidental? That's the thrust of the Grain article. If you'd like a copy, you can get it off of the webpage. It's www.grain.org, spelled G-R-A-I-N. Again, that's www.grain.org. Wild birds and poultry should not mix. That's what they're telling us. But backyard chickens, are they the vectors or are they the victims? Well, the bird conservation community has helped us to understand how wild birds are victims, not the vectors of highly pathogenic avian influenza. The highly pathogenic strains of bird flu develop in poultry, most likely in poultry exposed to milder strains that live naturally in wild bird populations. Within the crowded poultry operations of the factory farms, the mild virus evolves rapidly towards more pathogenic and highly transmissible forms capable of jumping species and spreading back into wild birds, which are defenseless against this new strain. In this sense, then, the H5N1 influenza is a poultry virus killing wild birds. It's not the other way around. It's not the wild birds spreading the virus, killing the poultry. Now, the same argument holds for small-scale poultry production. Bird flu does not evolve to highly pathogenic forms in backyard poultry operations, where low density and genetic diversity keep the viral load to a low level. Backyard poultry are the victims of bird flu strains brought in from elsewhere. When backyard farms are separated from the source of highly pathogenic bird flu, the virus seems to die out or evolve towards a less pathogenic form. Let me read that again. When backyard farms are separated from the source of this highly pathogenic bird flu, the virus seems to die out or evolve towards a less pathogenic form. So the solution to bird flu in the final analysis is to get rid of the factory farms. That's never going to happen. Government and big business are in bed together. And it's more economically feasible, it's more profitable to grow birds on these factory farms, to raise cattle, to finish cattle, as we use the term here in the United States, on feedlots, to raise pigs in these huge factory farms. It's dirty, it's pollutant, and it promotes disease. But boy, does it make money. And after all, that's the bottom line. It's like genetically modified food. GMOs don't do anything for the average Joe Sixpack or Juan Valdez who's trying to eke out a living on the hillsides of Colombia. But it does a hell of a lot for factory farms, for the elitists. It does a great deal for the multinational corporations like Archer Daniels Midland and Tyson Foods and the big multinational corporations. To give you an illustration, the other day I had a lady, a local lady here, ask me if she could buy eggs from me. Now, my chickens are a typical little backyard flock that run around eating birds that just are eating bugs, rather, not birds, they're eating bugs. And seeds on the ground and acorns. And of course, I feed them a little grain. They can have oats, or they can run around picking up bugs. And as a result, I did a little research, and I discovered that it costs me about $2 a dozen to produce eggs here. And that doesn't include any labor. I don't charge anything for my labor, just the feed that I have to put into those birds. And the buildings and the roofs and the costs, the direct costs, the dollars out of pocket that it costs for me to keep 40 or 50 chicken, cost me about $2 a dozen for eggs. They're not very efficient layers. They're not in the factory farm mode. They're free-range chickens, and everything that they eat's natural and normal. We don't feed them any genetically modified feeds. We don't give them egg-laying mash. We don't give them chemicals and drugs and antibiotics. And I just have a handful of them, and they produce about a dozen to a dozen and a half eggs a day. Once in a while, you'll get two dozen eggs out of 40 chickens. So if this was a commercial operation, you know, I'd starve to death. But it costs me about $2, and I'm willing to pay the $2 a dozen for the eggs because I want clean, organic, fresh eggs. And I have quite a few extra eggs left over, and this lady asked me if she too could buy these farm fresh eggs, and I said, sure, I'll sell them to you for $2, $2 a dozen. And this lady was absolutely incensed. I mean, it was just like I'd slapped her across the face with a dead fish. And she quickly informed me that eggs in the grocery store are only a dollar a dozen. And I said, now that's the miracle of modern factory farming. It's the miracle of modern American technology and agriculture. And so I pointed out to her that in the old days, now I haven't been in the commercial end of chicken farming for many years, but when I was a kid, I used to work in the poultry business, and I was in the chicken business. I'm pretty familiar with poultry, at least chickens. I don't know much about swans and ducks and geese and so on, but I'm pretty familiar with chickens. And I can remember as a kid back in the 1950s, we'd get an egg a day from a chicken. I mean, in the 50s, an egg a day. And we kept them in cages, and we had a little minor factory farm, and we fed them a mash ration that came from the poultry producers of Northern California. And this egg ration that was mixed up contained 28 chemicals. 28 chemicals. These 28 chemicals included such things as arsenic, dehydrostreptomycin, terramycin, and a whole host and plethora of other chemicals that would induce these chickens to lay more eggs. There was 11 pounds of these chemicals per ton of feed. They're like trace elements. There's not very much in there, but, you know, arsenic's a deadly poison, but when you feed it in small quantities, it makes chickens lay more eggs. And then we kept our chickens under lights, so at night the lights would go on so that the chickens could eat 24 hours a day. And a chicken suffers from a thing called burnout, because a chicken only has about 400 or 500 eggs in them when they're born. And then when a chicken is born, a baby chick, the total number of eggs that that chicken is ever going to lay in its lifetime is already in that little baby chick. It grows and develops. And then that chicken will lay that egg. Typically, a normal chicken lays an egg about every other day, sometimes maybe three a week. And then they lay just in the spring. Like right now, as spring is coming on, the chickens are beginning to lay more eggs. And then they make nests, and then they set on those eggs and they hatch them out. Those are what we call setting chickens. And right now I've got two of these setters, and I've got 12 eggs under each one of them, and they'll hatch those chicks out. And they'll typically hatch about two-thirds, or about eight chicks. And half of them are going to be male, and half of them female. So you have to have about, 10 or 12 setting chickens that hatch out 50% females, so that they every year will replace themselves. And so my little backyard flock replaces itself. And then the roosters, male chickens, you can eat them. You can raise them up and eat them. And this is the way people have been living, for thousands of years, taking care of these little backyard flocks. They're not nearly as efficient as the commercial variety, where they get out of these 400 or 500 eggs, they can get 365 eggs out of that chicken in 1 year. And then send that chicken off to a Campbell soup place. We'll make chicken noodle soup out of it. And because they get an egg a day out of those chickens, and because they feed those chemicals to force them to lay those eggs faster, they can get more production. And by getting more production, they keep the chicken less time. And they have a more efficient methodology. They can produce those eggs for about 50 or 75 cents a dozen, and then they sell them for a dollar a dozen in the store. Isn't that just special? Now, you get to eat those 28 chemicals. Now, that's from back in the 50s. I don't have any idea what they're putting in here now. I saw a tag the other day from a sack of feed. It had words on there that I couldn't even pronounce, just being a truck driver and all. And it had a great big long list on there, great big long list in fine print on the feed tag on the sack. I gave up after about the third or fourth word, but I figured right then that there wasn't anything in that bag that I wanted to eat. Now, evidently, this lady wants to eat that because she decided not to buy eggs here. She decided to buy eggs from the grocery store. Fortunately for me, I'm not in the chicken business, and I don't depend upon my selling eggs over here for my living, like a lot of people around the world probably do. But here's the way I kind of figured that. You see, it costs me $2 to produce a dozen eggs. And if I sell that dozen eggs to that lady for a dollar, then I have to pay her a dollar a dozen to eat healthy, nutritious eggs. Now, let me tell you, boys and girls, I don't really care what you eat. I couldn't give a rat's rectum less whether you eat eggs that are filled with dehydrostreptomycin and terramycin and arsenic or not. It's your choice to make. But for $2 a dozen, you can eat clean, healthy, nutritious eggs. And that's what most of the people in the world actually eat today. But the major factory farms want to change that. What they're trying to do is to eliminate the backyard flocks. That's what the real motivation is. So we're going to use this H5N1 flu virus to just scare the living peewadden out of everybody. And as I already pointed out to you, a number of countries here have banned backyard flocks. Did you catch that? Let me see if I can read this again. Austria has a ban on outdoor poultry from October to December, and the ordinance extended indefinitely around area where the H5N1 infected swans were found. So there's Austria. Canada, they have a ban on outdoor poultry in the province of Quebec. In China, the Anhui provincial government declares all backyard poultry must be kept in cages. Complete ban on backyard birds in Hong Kong. In Croatia, they have a ban on outdoor poultry during migration season. In France, a ban on outdoor poultry with some exceptions. In Germany, they just have a plain ban on all outdoor poultry. In Italy, free-range birds, which represent about 20% of the poultry sector, have to be under wire screens. In the Netherlands, they have a ban on outdoor poultry with some exceptions. In Nigeria, backyard poultry and birds are banned within the federal capital territory. In Norway, they have a ban on outdoor poultry in 8 southern counties. In Slovenia, they have a ban on outdoor poultry, period. In Sweden, they've banned outdoor poultry, period. In Switzerland, poultry must be kept within roofed enclosures. In Thailand, restrictions on free-ranging ducks and a ban on live poultry markets in Bangkok and slaughterhouses move to the outskirts. They have forced collectivization of small poultry flocks in central provinces. In the Ukraine, the sale of live poultry and poultry products produced by private village households is prohibited in the autonomous region of Crimea. The ban does not apply to factory-produced poultry. Did you get that? The ban does not apply to factory-produced poultry. So the Tyson Foods, the ADMs, the major factory farm corporate entities, they're not affected, at least not in the Ukraine. In Vietnam, the ban on poultry farming in towns and cities. Now, there is a war going on here against poultry raising. And there's a little doubt in my mind but what they're going to succeed. I mean, after all, they have the weight of the police power of the state. And they have the weight of science and the United Nations behind them. But what do you think the ultimate outcome of this is going to be? You know, looking down the road here 10, 20 years. When we eliminate from planet Earth, not just in Vietnam or Austria, but when we eliminate in Australia and New Zealand and the United States and Canada, all backyard flocks, when it becomes illegal, when we ban chickens and the production of eggs and chicken, like we ban marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, what do you think the ultimate outcome will be? Well, for you people living in Cleveland, Toledo, New York, and Los Angeles, it doesn't matter one way or the other. You people haven't seen a real egg in your lifetimes. You wouldn't know what the hell one looked like, what it tasted like, or what it's composed of. It's irrelevant. To 97% of Americans, it's irrelevant. And in most cases, in all the big cities like Hong Kong and Beijing and London and so on around the world, people, they don't keep backyard chickens anyway. It's just rural people. People in South America, you know, some little poor Indian guys, you know, like Juan Valdez up in the mountains of Colombia picking coffee beans. He probably has a little backyard flock of chickens. Or a George Gordon, or, you know, some health food crazy, some hippie, you know, wearing earrings and long hair. Those are the only people that really care about it. But in three locations, that is in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the underdeveloped regions of the world, the majority of people live out in the country, and those people that live in the country depend upon these little backyard flocks, and we're going to stamp them out around the world under the guise of, we're protecting you, we're government, and we're here to protect you. Now, you just saw this happen in Europe over this this blackleg. See, blackleg isn't even fatal. If you ate a cow that was suffering from blackleg, it's no big deal. It isn't transmissible to humans anyway. But they wanted to stamp it out. And so they went out there and they killed cattle by the, I don't know, millions, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands. And it's curable. It's true that the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization doesn't know how to cure it. I don't deny that. Veterinarians don't know how to cure it. But us little guys down here on the farm, we do. But you know, when government gets in here and they say, hey, listen, you know, you people in the city are being threatened with blackleg. You're being threatened with H5N1 flu strains. What they're appealing to is your fear. Remember, you're motivated by vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. So they're appealing to your fear. And they'll succeed. A little doubt in my mind. But how is that going to affect you long term? Well, the only poultry being produced then in the world is going to come from the factory farms. Which in fact is the only place where the H5N1 flu is generated and transported. Do you have any idea what the ramifications of that's going to be? You take a look at Revelation chapter 6. And there's four horsemen. It talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and one of them over here is disease, pestilence. Famine's one of them, but disease and pestilence. You, ladies and gentlemen, are committing suicide with these factory farms. Yes, it's economical. And yes, it produces cheap food. But boys and girls, do you really believe that buying dollar a dozen eggs laced with bird flu is a good value? Honest to God, do you really believe that feedlot produced beef, which contains mad cow disease, although in this country we don't call it mad cow disease, we call it Downer cow syndrome. Have you noticed you haven't heard very much about that lately, have you? Did you think mad cow disease just went away? It disappeared. If it isn't in the news every night, it must have gone away. It's no longer a problem. And then there's the pollution that goes along with these factory farms. And what do you do to get rid of all of that manure? You know, all of that byproduct, you know, that comes off these factory farms. We're going to feed it to the fish in the lake. You're going to feed this H5N1 laden manure feces to the fish in the lake. And then the birds come in here, the wild birds, and they eat the fish in the lake. Well, then, are the wild birds the victims? Or are the wild birds the cause of this bird flu? You know, there has to be a cause and effect for everything. And when there is a cause and effect relationship here, it would seem like to me, just in the concept of good sense, that we would want to isolate the cause of the problem and then eliminate that cause. And if the cause is factory farming, don't you think maybe we ought to have some limitations on the size of these factory farms? I mean, how big can they get? When I was a kid, a bird farm, a chicken farm with 10,000 birds was humongous. 3,000 birds was normal. A man could make a living on 3,000 chickens. 10,000 chickens, he was big. He was a big fish in a small pond. Now they've got hundreds of thousands, and now they're talking about millions. Do you really think that that's a good agricultural practice? I'll leave you with that thought, and we'll come back to this tomorrow when we talk about producing good food on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course, until then. Thanks for listening, everyone, and good night, friends.